You're listening to an Olive Pit production. Welcome to the show. I'll be your host. Let's get to it.
Hey guys, welcome back to another edition of Look for the Helpers with Dr. Nicole Novega and our special guest today, Mike Vashur.
How you doing?
Yay. Yay. Have one of those.
Yes.
Oh, that's the wrong one.
Oh, they're laughing.
Of course they're laughing.
Oh, that's the wrong. Oh, there he is.
Oh, like that's every time I walk into a room.
Yeah,
yes, me too. That's very magical.
It is nice.
So today we're going to be talking a little bit about grief with Mike. But we don't want to jump over our icebreakers.
Mm, absolutely.
I have some very exciting ones today. Can't I know wait. Nicole has been disappointed with every single one of my icebreakers so far. She's going to be blown out of the water.
I'm excited.
Nicole, what's yours?
Oh, man, I thought you were going to go. Now you put me on the spot. All right, wait, no. So I'm gonna give Mike mine because you haven't answered mine either yet. I think.
I did.
You did?
You didn't like my answer. The guy was dead.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay. So mine is if anyone was to play you in a movie about your life, who would you have play that movie? He has to be alive is the stipulation.
She added that part now.
Yeah, because they're telling me dead people.
Jonah Hill.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, my God, yes.
There you go.
Yeah. That's perfect.
Yeah, that's right, Joe Diaz. Yep, absolutely right.
All right.
I like it.
I like it.
Yeah,
that.
Like a mix between like Jonah Hill and Bruce Willis.
Oh.
You see it?
Yeah.
I do.
I just put the Bruce Willis in so I don't feel so bad.
Yeah. So
just say
if we're
yes.
doing that, I'm just going to say Chuck Norris for me.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, I like that.
I called you Chuck when I came here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got confused.
Speaking of Jonah for a second, you just reminded me that there's an amazing Netflix special and it's called, I think it's called Stutz, STUTZ. Mm-hmm. Now I feel like I got to look it up to make sure. Mm-hmm. But it's basically a documentary about him and his therapist.
Oh.
And what's really interesting about it is that it's a... Well, maybe it's just because I'm the therapist and I'm seeing it through this lens. You might have a different takeaway, but one of the takeaways I think is that his therapist has thrown out anything that he's ever learned about doing therapy because you're trained to have really strict boundaries, not cross any, you know, lines at all. And these two have this like love and this bond that surpasses all of the things that you learn in school. I mean, it's tremendous. You guys should check it out.
Okay. Right.
So I think it's Stutz.
Stutz.
Yeah. We're always looking for something good.
Yeah, see me in Stutz. Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to give you choices.
Okay.
Okay. You can pick a category and then I'll give you, and you can pick, each of you can pick a different category if you'd like, or you can pick the same. Okay. It's up to you.
Okay.
So you can have a quirky. You can have food or drink.
What's the first one?
Yeah, say that again.
Quirky.
Quirky?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Quirky.
Yeah, quirky.
Quirky.
I thought you were saying quirky.
Me too. Yeah. He is saying quirky.
Yeah.
No, quirky.
Come on, man.
It's not the dog corgi. Quirky.
C-O-R-K-Y.
Q-U-I-R-K-Y.
Okay, that's quirky.
Quirky.
That's what I
we're
said.
We're going to have to review these before you start.
All right. This is going to be a show about my pronunciation. Quirky.
Well, there's two of us that didn't hear it.
Yeah.
We heard the same thing.
Yeah,
we're hearing something different.
General.
Okay.
Okay.
Entertainment. Or have you ever?
This is being recorded, right?
Yes.
All right, we'll scratch the last one.
Have you ever? No.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
they're all pretty.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep, they're G-rated. Okay.
All right, I'll take that one.
You take Howie. Yeah. Have you ever?
Yeah.
Okay.
You do the same thing?
No, I'm not doing that.
All right.
Okay.
Might as well dive in.
Have you ever met a celebrity?
I have. I met the band Shinedown.
Okay.
And I met... couple of wrestlers when I was a kid, WWF wrestlers.
Really?
I guess celebrity, I don't know.
Yeah, but, I mean, well, they were, I would have thought so.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Hulk Hogan.
For sure.
All right. The Undertaker.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Papa Shango.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Ultimate Warrior. Oh. Mankind.
Don't get me started.
Oh, man.
My uncle, by the way, was a WWF wrestler when I was
get
a kid.
The heck, what was his name? Here.
He was one of the guys that would lose all the time.
Oh, I see.
But his name was Silvano Souza.
Huh.
Because don't forget, it was all based out of Hartford,
right?
Connecticut.
Hartford, Connecticut. That's right.
We were young. It's changed now, but that's where it was.
Oh, and not to one up you, but I dated the niece of a very famous WWF star who shall remain nameless.
Interesting.
I'll tell you after the show.
Was it Hulk Hogan?
I wish, no.
I'm sorry.
He's a beautiful man, though. So his niece has got to be.
All right. So are you going to pick one? Quirky.
Quirky.
Food or drink? Personal. General.
Well,
entertainment.
I feel like now that he's talked about the celebrities that he met, I think I'll just go with that.
Have you ever met a celebrity?
We'll have a consistent theme.
Yeah. And then you can learn.
It's difficult for me to say because I've met a lot of celebrities in my life.
Wow.
Like probably too many to name.
Whoa, right? Look at me.
Yeah.
Wow.
But if I had to pick the coolest and like most funky famous celebrity versus my own personal favorite celebrity, I would say my favorite would be Caleb Followill, who's the singer of Kings of Leon, who I am 100% obsessed
with. That's a great band.
Okay.
And I stalked him. Well, I stalked the band in Nashville probably like 7 or 8 years ago when they were dropping a new album.
When we say stalk.
Yeah.
Were you hiding in bushes?
Right.
Close.
Okay.
Close. Yeah. Yeah. I did go to, they bought this mansion in Nashville and I did actually drive to the mansion and walked onto the property and they had just finished their show the night before in Nashville. And all of their like roadies had all their stuff. And I like walked right into the roadies down the driveway trying to see if I could see them somewhere. But they acted as if I was not even there. I was a ghost. Like,
until
they didn't even
the
see
cops
me.
Jumped you, cuffed right. you, and threw you in the back of the
I decided
car.
Since they weren't acknowledging me, I just left. I was like, okay, I guess they're not here.
This wasn't as fun as
so
I thought.
So Caleb, the very next day I flew out and I literally ran into Caleb at the airport in the Hudson News shop getting a thing of water.
Really?
Wow.
Got a photo with him.
Awesome.
Don't like to show it because it's a horrible photo of me. But that's my favorite celebrity. Also met probably the coolest, funkiest one is Snoop.
Oh.
If you Google my name.
I've seen this double G.
You have a picture, right?
Yes.
Yes, I've seen this
picture.
If
you Google me, there's definitely a picture of me and Snoop online. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's pretty exciting. I mean, I'm Snoop.
Yeah, I mean,
who doesn't want to meet Snoop?
Yeah, and it was Halloween night. It was great.
Really?
Yeah.
Just a chance at
Joe's
barbecue shop?
No, my friend, she was the manager of the coolest rock club in Providence, Rhode Island, the box office manager. So that's why I've met.
Okay.
I've met
All right, so
lots and lots of.
Yeah, she'd be like, hey, Snoop's coming into town.
Yeah, yeah. We'd have the opera box. We'd go backstage. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It was cool.
I have not met a celebrity.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll share some of mine with you.
Yeah. Snoop.
Yeah.
Call Snoop. You know what? Let's get him on the show.
Yes.
It'd be great.
Yes.
Yeah. Next episode, starring Snoop, guys. You heard it here.
That's right. Stay tuned.
Yeah. Thanks to Nicole.
Yes.
All right.
All right. I like where you're going with the icebreakers.
I'm moving up, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, just
nice
wait.
Work.
There's some really good ones in there.
Nice.
Really
I'd like to add
ones.
That I also met Jocko Willink. Also,
oh, that must have been intense.
Favorites. I do have a picture of that. Also,
he's awesome.
I also look stupid in that picture.
Is this like
because I'm going like this? I was like, I'm not even kidding you. I ruined the entire picture.
Oh, man.
That's amazing. Yeah. I love that.
Terrible.
So we talked a little bit about. You know, we're going to talk about grief. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to really talk about grief. I'm sure we will talk about grief in this way, but the way we're starting this is not really talking about grief that we have. Ultimately, we do have it. But we're going to talk about grief that is coming from our patient's family. and how we deal with this. Because ultimately, I feel like we bear that burden as well, a little piece every time. And Mike has got something that he wrote, which was really amazing.
Phenomenal.
No, thank you.
It was very good.
Thank you.
If you'd like to read a piece of that,
sure.
We'd love to hear that and then go from there.
Okay.
And I just put in a little plug before
of course,
you go.
Yeah.
Is that I've been talking for a few years about, and we've talked about this, mm-hmm. about putting together a writing group mm-hmm. Where we can, because I know a bunch of other writers out there. So I'm just saying that any other writers out there, you want to come and join our writing group. Mike and I and Bree Kelly are probably going to start a small writing group. So other writers, let me know. Contact me, contact Mike, contact Bree Kelly, because we're gonna make this happen.
Absolutely.
All right.
Very cool.
Well, you're responding to the home of an elderly male found by his wife on the bathroom floor. A few minutes before you arrive on scene, your dispatch notes update and say TCPR in progress. You arrive on scene to find an elderly woman pushing on her husband's chest in the bathroom. She is sobbing and clearly exhausted. You help the woman to her feet and see the panic and sorrow in her eyes. She already knows what you know, but she feels it in her bones, not in a clinical sense. You call cardiac arrest over the radio and begin moving through the algorithms. Everyone knows their role and performs at the highest level, but you know, like she does, the outcome will probably be poor. All you can do is the best you can with what you have. All she can do is pray for a miracle. Tragically, your efforts are futile, and this man, husband, father, brother, and son is passed. Everyone in the room already knew this, but didn't dare whisper the truth to the woman he loved until now. That vulnerable woman, wife, mother, sister, and daughter. You're about to tell her that the man she has loved for 60 years is dead, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. The world slips away as the woman wails in sorrow. You take her arms to steady her as the truth forces her to double over in agony. You see the horror wash across her face over and over again, and she tries to take grasp of the situation. She begins to tremble. This is the job, right here, right now. We can practice all the skills we want, recite cardiology, pharmacology, pathophysiology, know every indication and contraindications of every medication and all the other disciplines of our job. How do we even begin to manage this? I'm not exactly sure. What I do know is that this moment will be the most significant moment in someone else's life, a story they will tell in times of sorrow, melancholy, and hopefully one day, as a time a total stranger tried to save her husband and gave her comfort. Comforted her in a living hell full of panic and confusion. How does one bear witness to this over and over again without it exacting a toll? As if we have some bottomless well of spiritual and psychological fortitude to drink from. In case you hadn't heard, we don't. As horrible and depressing as this scene is, we can sacrifice a bit of ourselves and shine in that moment. That is the single moment where we can be present and endure this with them. We can remember that when the world was filled with pain and sorrow, we reached into that fire and held on to them. We will burn, we will scar, and these scars we will carry. This moment is going to be significant, regardless of your part in the story. How will this person remember you? What will they remember about you? How will you feel about yourself when you're alone and it's quiet? How can we be present and share in the pain of others when we are also stumbling our way through life? Now imagine for a moment you weren't present, appeared indifferent or preoccupied. Maybe it's 7:30 and you were supposed to be off shift 30 minutes ago. Maybe this is your third cardiac arrest of the shift and you haven't slept. You haven't eaten. Oh, and you're behind on the mortgage and your family doesn't understand why you're always so tired. Who could blame you for just going through the motions? I certainly couldn't blame you. It's a reality that we have to take into account. Maybe the true coin of the realm is sacrifice, a willing sacrifice in honor of truth and love, and how we pay this and move forward in a healthy manner is up for debate. But we certainly can agree that we will move farther together. Thank you.
That's amazing, right?
Yeah, I love that.
And thanks. I think that it hits so many points that really started this show as trying to get as much help and recognition out there that we all kind of bear these burdens, and whether it's from some of the hardest calls like you're talking about, or even some of the easiest calls where we're just helping people, getting them to the hospital and everything. You know, I think everything leaves a little, takes a little piece of us, right?
Yeah. I think the thing that I love about this conversation is, you know, what struck me so much about a previous conversation that we had about this very thing is that you are so passionate about being present in that moment, looking the people in the eye, taking the time to use true empathy when you do this work. And lots of times, as you say in your in your writing, that you don't blame people for the people who are just going through the motions, because of course, like, being detached is one of the things, is a skill that you guys learn to do very well, very quickly. But that's what's so interesting, is this juxtaposition that you come from, this place that you come from that says, I'm not going to do that.
No.
I'm not going to be detached, even though I understand why people do it. But I'm committed to being present. And that's the toughest part of this work, I think.
Yeah.
Talk more about that.
So, you know, it's tough to... It's tough to do it once,
right?
So it would be tough to be completely present in a time of tragedy for somebody else once, but now you're going to sign up for 30 years?
Right.
Like, come on. Like, we should talk about this. Because if you can't do that, then you're paying the price whether you like it or not, right? So you can either be present and feel it with them, or you can remain indifferent to them, and you got to feel that, because you're going to feel it.
Right.
And all those people that you leave behind, the patients' families, everyone else, they're going to feel it too.
Right.
So this is a job. Privilege is a strange word, but you are privileged to bear witness to the horror of someone else's life.
Right.
What role do you play in that story? Are you going to be the villain?
Right.
Are you going to be the hero? Which one are you going to be? Right. And you got to make that decision before that happens. Because, you know, everyone likes to think they're the hero. But when you become indifferent, it's easy to become the villain.
Right? When did you come to this decision? I mean, this is a decision point in some ways for you. Do you remember what was it that got you to feel so strongly about this issue of being in the moment and not just being detached and unemotional about it?
It's going to sound strange, but I think it was it goes way back to feeling like if you looked away from bad things, that the outcome would be even worse, because you were allowing it to move around you without acknowledging it.
Right.
And
almost like you're not honoring it.
Yeah.
Right.
Like if you're not going to pay attention now, then it's going to get you when you're not looking.
Yeah.
So, you know, and without some wisdom behind that, it becomes pathological. Right, it becomes a disease of the mind, because you don't know how to set boundaries, you don't know how to compartmentalize, which in and by itself can be a good thing, but once again, when it's done without any wisdom, you compartmentalize to the point where it becomes pathological. So it's a very treacherous landscape, and I got no idea how anyone does it. I don't.
Well, yeah, and I think from a compartmentalization standpoint, you have to do it. That's the skill we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. You put it on the shelf to get to the next call, But at some point, as you're saying, I'm just using different words.
Sure.
At some point, if you don't take it off the shelf and look at it in the eyes and put it under a microscope for a little bit, like, it's going to bite you in the ass at some point.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
It's not if it's wet.
Right. It's just like being able to control it, right?
Right.
You're going to take this in.
Right.
You need to be able to own it and control it. Because if you don't control it,
right,
before you know it, it will be out of control and you won't be able to handle.
Right.
Right? So I think ownership and accepting it and, you know, talking about it and, you know, taking it head on with the family is like being able to control it and put it where you want on that shelf rather than it being on the shelf and then unknowingly it's coming off at some point, right? Mm-hmm. And it might not be tomorrow. It might be in 3 years after you've got 30 of these on the shelf that you've never really addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got to take them all at once.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And what you leave yourself open to is that if you're not aware of what the things are that make you feel a certain way, you are likely to be activated instead of triggered, activated by something that reminds you of an event that you don't even have in the forefront of your mind.
Right. Sure.
A smell, a song, you know, some painting, right? Who knows? No, you can't, you don't know what your brain is taking in during the tragedy that is being imprinted because there's so much stuff, right? It could be, you know, this Burger King, there's a Burger King crown behind Brian's head right now. And, you know, your brain's taking that in, but you might be somewhere 3 years later, see that Burger King, same exact crown, and it'll bring you right back to that moment in time. And so, you know, not stuffing it is, I think, the most important thing that you can do. And I want to put in a little plug for CISM. Because as much as people will say it's not beneficial, they don't want to go, I don't need it, there is something to be said for going, walking through the process of this is what happened, this was my role, these are the things that occurred, and finding something positive about the tragedy, right? One thing that you know, that you can say is good about the event. And maybe it's just that everybody did a really good job.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a funny thing you bring up CISM. We were actually talking about this earlier. We are going to petition that we change the name of CISM.
Oh, yeah. What do you want to call it?
Just, we don't know yet, but critical incident stress management. Yeah. It just sounds, you know, I think we should come up with something else.
I think the International Foundation will disagree with you.
Probably.
Lots of people. Could I just add on to something you said? Yeah. So in, you know, I noticed, I've noticed that when you stuff lots of things down and then something does activate you, what's also stressing is if you stuff too many things down and you have a reaction, you won't understand where it's coming from.
Right.
Which is, it's distressing in itself because now you're having reactions to things that aren't correlating with what's happening.
Right.
And I think, you said you went to a seminar about trauma?
Yes.
Is that right? Yes. It was like complex.
4 days. Yes.
4 days. Sounds four traumatic days. All by itself.
It was.
My goodness.
It was. There was a lot of strange things that happened.
Was there?
There was protesting in the back of the conference room.
People were pro-trauma?
They were protesting why they weren't talking about a solution for Palestine and Gaza in the middle of this thing.
Really?
It was, it was mind-boggling, and it disrupted, it was like complete disruptors in this.
Wow.
Hundreds and hundreds of people at this
Are you serious?
Yeah, it was very strange. Anyway, please continue.
Yeah, I don't really know how to even go off of that.
I'm sorry.
That's
it was just, that's amazing. It was traumatic, is what I was saying.
I bet. So, you know, and I think the best thing that I've learned is that I don't have any answers.
Yes.
I just don't know what to do sometimes with it, so I have to ask somebody.
Right.
You know, just ask someone who knows more about it than I do, or someone that knows just as much as I do, or someone that knows less than I do, because they might have a critical insight to it. And I think we were talking about that before.
I was going to bring up, like, you had told us a story, and I'll have you tell it, but you had told a story about a patient that I believe you had transported, and you were talking to him. And
sure. So it was a pediatric arrest. And my partner and I, you know, we ran the arrest and transported. And we kind of like checked in with each other afterwards. And of course, everyone's okay. Who could possibly be upset by that? So we went back to station, chatted about it again for maybe another minute. And something strange happened after shift. We both left work. We hadn't discussed this at all. This just happened. We both left work, both went to a Publix, both bought our wives flowers, and then went home and talked to our wives at the same time. So that was kind of like a real moment where I could see a chip in the armor, you know, where I actually, even my wife noticed, like, you know, where's all that ice in your veins? It turns out I was lying to myself. There's no ice in my veins.
Right.
You know, I'm just a regular guy. Right. Just like everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, yep. Regular person. So, you know, that was an interesting moment.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. We had talked about something else too, where you had talked about rituals, you know, and there, you know, it's always good. And while maybe sometimes it's hard to find your ritual, or maybe your ritual, you do your ritual and you don't even recognize it as a ritual. But you were talking about somebody who was a homicide detective and had been for 30 years,
right?
And seen the worst of the worst out of Miami.
Yep.
And
he had a ritual that he did. He had a chair outside of his front door where he smoked his cigars. His wife wouldn't let him smoke in the house. So it was a copper dish where he put his, you know, cigars out in. So when he came home from work, he would kind of chuck the coin. He had a lucky coin in his pocket. He would chuck this coin into the bowl, and it made like this like ringing sound. And then he would go in the house, take off his detective hat, cop hat, and then he became father, husband, and everything else. Then when he left for work in the morning, he picked the coin back up. So it's ceremony. Mm-hmm. It may even seem silly, but the ceremony is the recognition that you need to not be a cop when you're home, right, or a paramedic, or an EMT, or a captain, or anybody or else.
Firefighter.
Whatever it is. Nurse, doctor. When you get home, you're not that person anymore. Right. And when you come to work, you're not a dad.
Right.
Right? You're not a husband. You're whatever you are, and you have to be that for every call.
Until you leave. Yeah.
And managing those two things, especially in the line of work where you're dealing with tragedy, man, if you don't pay attention, man, it's going to get you.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. You need to be able to control it.
Yeah.
Right. You need to be able to understand how to control it for you. Cause everybody's going to be different, right?
Sure.
Everybody's going to control their emotions and their tragedy, mm-hmm, and how they manage it differently. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of a ritual. And, you know, when we were talking about that, I was thinking, I usually, when I drive home, I like to drive home with the windows open, right? And it's just me and the radio. I'm just driving home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that's part of my thing, right?
Sure.
I get that fresh air. And even though it's hot, but for some reason, that's just how I like to do it, mm-hmm, right? And it kind of made me realize that, hey, you know, that's probably my ritual, because it is something I do every day.
Yeah.
You know, when I leave work, it's roll the windows down, come home, turn my music on, mm-hmm, and just zen out till I get home.
That's awesome.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's important that everybody, you know, consider or just look inside or try and find your bit of peace to separate that profession from home life. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. To a certain extent, I would think that part of that ritual is also just removing your uniform too.
True.
Right?
Very true.
This element of, even if people don't have a ritual, in some ways, everyone's doing it in that respect of, mm-hmm, I'm removing my, whether you, you know, change before you go home or you wait until you go home to change.
Right.
There's that idea of like, I'm removing this thing that makes me who I am and transitioning into this other
superhero
character.
Superhero uniform.
That's right.
Yeah, your cape.
That's right.
Taking your cape off. Yeah.
And I think the important thing is it's not the ritual. It's the fact that the ritual would exist.
Exactly.
Right? So there's got to be a reason for it. Right. Rituals exist for a reason. We don't just do things.
Right.
We do things to celebrate something or to memorialize something or whatever the case is, but they exist because a reason for it manifested itself. So we should, just be cognizant of the fact that you can't be all things at all times.
Right.
I think the other important thing about this conversation is that one of the things that we know about cumulative stress in first responders is that when people find themselves at the end of their career and they're ready to retire, oftentimes we're now seeing very, very high rates of suicidal ideation in retirees, in depression, anxiety, poor physical outcomes, health outcomes. And I think this idea of recognizing that this is a role that you play for a certain amount of hours in a day, in a week, and it's not your entire identity. Mm-hmm. And so the removing of the uniform or having this ritual of recognizing that I'm not always the medic.
Right.
Right. Or I'm not always the cop. I'm not always the firefighter.
Right.
I'm also, like you said,
yeah,
a dad, a husband, a brother, a friend. I'm all these other things. I have hobbies. I might have another business.
Sure.
But that this isn't the be all end all, so that when you do come to a point where you no longer decide to do this as an occupation, that you have an intact identity that is something other than the first responder role that you have.
So important, right?
Because when people feel like they've lost their identity,
what's left?
They start to feel like, who am I?
Exactly.
Right? And so we need to make sure people understand, like, I'm a whole person, whether I do this job or don't do this job. This job doesn't define my full identity. It's just a role that I play.
Would there be a way for you to define the stacking of trauma from personal life to professional? Like, is there a term for that that makes sense?
I mean, we call it cumulative trauma.
Cumulative trauma?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Yeah.
It's basically cumulative secondary traumatic stress is what it is.
Wow.
The secondary trauma is the idea of what you had said earlier, that you're bearing witness to someone else's trauma.
Sure.
And so that's secondary trauma. Primary trauma is the idea that your life was in jeopardy.
Okay.
So if you ran into the burning building or if somebody's shooting at you, right, you're that's experiencing a primary trauma. Secondary trauma is that you're witnessing somebody else's tragedy.
So then if a call was to be something like that, one person could have primary trauma and secondary trauma from one call.
Yes, and that it becomes an accumulation, right? It's compounding, over the years. So it's basically cumulative primary and cumulative secondary traumatic stress.
Could you imagine signing up for this willingly?
Right. No. I ask everyone that. I was just training at the...
we do.
Seriously. Yeah.
Right. I ask all of our NEOP classes why.
Yeah.
And I just trained at the police have like a pre-deployment small academy for new cops going on the road. And I just trained them yesterday. And I asked them the same thing. Of all of the professions in the world that you could choose, why this, right? I'm always fascinated by why people choose.
What are the answers you get? Because I'm kind of fascinated by it too. And I, you know, because I can tell you when I came in, I certainly didn't realize.
Right.
Right. It's not something you think about, I want to go be a paramedic and I want to look at everybody's tragedy for 30 years.
Right.
Right. Mm. That's certainly not what you think.
Well, the thing is that people don't know.
Right.
What I find interesting is that when I go talk to the new members of our team at NEOP or the academy at the police department, I'm talking at them for 2 hours about all of these things that we're talking about now, But they have no idea what I'm talking about because they haven't been on the road yet. Mm-hmm. So they haven't seen anything. There's no context to what I'm saying, right? I'm just saying words about gruesome tragedies that you might see or grief that you're going to come across. They have no idea what that actually feels like and looks like. So it's almost, it's better than nothing, but it's not enough because they don't even know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I can tell you, like, I didn't. Now I can say that I did this because I wanted to come and help people, which is ultimately after 20 years, it's the same thing, right? Like I am helping them, but I'm still bearing witness to all of these things, right?
Lots of the answers are, there's a good percentage of them that come from a first responder family. And then there's another very, I would say the next highest percentage of for the answer is that they were helped by a first responder. Somebody in their life was helped by a first responder and it impacted them greatly.
Okay.
You know, somebody came in and did CPR on their grandfather or, you know, something like that. Some tragedy happened in their family and a first responder came in and helped. That's another big one.
Wow.
Lots of military people come to do this too. So those
what was your common reasoning?
I used to watch Rescue 911 when I was a kid.
Mm. Me too.
All right. And I thought that was actually...
It was my favorite show.
Yeah, mine too. Yep. That's right. So I was a truck driver before this. And then I was talking to my wife. We'd already been married a couple of years. She goes, you know, you want to keep driving a truck? And I'm like, I don't know. Kind of feel like I should do something else. She goes, well, like what? I said, well, I used to like that show, Rescue 911. She goes, okay. I went to work. Came in the next day. She goes, you're signed up for... EMT class.
Oh, that's awesome.
North Providence Fire Department.
North Providence, woo-woo.
Yep.
Really?
And I started EMT class and...
Never looked back.
No, and I became fascinated with everything, every part of it, learning about the anatomy and physics. You know, I got a GED. Education wasn't a thing. I was just a worker.
Right.
I was just going to work until the body gave out. And make some good choices along the way. That was the plan in my head.
Right.
And I found out that, man, stuff retains up there sometimes. And I started, and you know how it is when you first start learning things. You start babbling about everything, but you feel so proud of yourself because you can recite these things. You impress your friends and your family. And then you start actually helping people. And you might have good calls, you might have bad calls, but man, you're in it to win it. And you're all about this. And this is... This is the calling, and it's like that,
right?
You know, and it's, you know, it's a noble endeavor, but it's not free.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
I want to, can we segue back to grief while you say that it's not free?
Sure.
I wanted to talk about two concepts, and I wanted to read this little grief thing that I found on Instagram, but it's kind of beautiful. But I wanted, there's these two concepts about grief that are, I think, really prominent in the first responder world. And it's concepts called ambiguous grief and disenfranchised grief. And disenfranchised grief happens so much for you all because the idea is that your grief isn't... Disenfranchised grief means it's not acknowledged by others, that they don't acknowledge that you have a reason to grieve. So you end up kind of acting as if you're not experiencing grief because no one acknowledges your grief, right? Because it's not your grief. You're responding to somebody. It was a cardiac arrest, a pediatric arrest, a suicide, a bad car accident, but it didn't happen to you or your family. Mm-hmm. So therefore lots of people will be like, well, who cares? It's not your family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should, what are you crying about? Right? What are you upset about? Rub some dirt on it, right?
Exactly.
Get over it. So when you're not allowed to grieve, it becomes disenfranchised, right? And so you end up being like, well, what do I do with this thing? Because everybody around me tells me that I shouldn't be grieving over this thing that isn't my grief. And that can be difficult for people because then they end up stuffing it. You know, they put it away. They deny their own feelings, basically, right? And then ambiguous grief is the idea that you have no closure. Sometimes it happens for dispatchers, maybe more so than EMS, because you guys tend to be a little bit, you know, more active in this system, and you can see what the outcome is if you looked at hospital records or whatever, or talked to somebody at the hospital. But dispatchers often take the call, and they have no idea what happened after they pass that on to you guys. And it could be incredibly distressing for them as they as they take the call.
Oh, yeah.
And they have no idea what happens to this outcome. Could be domestic violence, could be a, you know, again, a pediatric arrest. And so when we're not allowed to grieve or even know the ending of a story, that creates this ambiguous grief, which is kind of a this unknown factor that you don't really get closure on. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I wanted to... because grief is such a cousin of trauma, I would call it, right? Or like a sibling of trauma, almost. They kind of go hand in hand, right? You can't witness other people's traumas without having grief, really. And you can't have your own traumas without experiencing a level of grief. This idea that you're no longer the person that you were before the tragic thing happened, right? One of the... When we first started doing research in like 2016, and we interviewed a cop back in Rhode Island, and he said, "I'm not a normal person anymore." And we actually made that the title of the article that we ended up publishing about this. But he's just, you know, there's lots of people that say, "This happened, and I've never been the same." You know, once this call happened, I've never been the same. And so here's this beautiful thing on grief. I would credit who it is, but no one's going to know. But it actually says it's by Rising Woman on Instagram. And it says, "Ocean, medicine, and grief. There's a saying, never turn your back to the ocean. In a moment, you could be swept away. If you're standing in the ocean and a big wave comes, you can duck under it or let it hit you. If you don't duck under the wave, chances are it will smash you in the face. Water all up your nose and in your eyes. You may even get washed away or tumbled beneath the water until being tossed into the shore. But the other option is to dive down and duck underneath the wave. If you've ever done this, you know that even if there's a 10-foot wave above you, when you dive deep enough, it's incredibly peaceful down there. Grief is like this. You can feel the wave coming, and if you resist it, the grief or the rage or the sadness may take you by surprise and carry you away. You resist because it's scary and uncomfortable, but the result is worse than what will happen if you allow the waves of grief to wash over you. Peace will not be found above the surface. It will not be found with your back turned to the ocean. There is medicine for you in the deep, and you will find that when you trust the waves as they come, you will begin to experience a type of freedom that only comes when we have the courage to let ourselves do the depths of those unknown places." I'm sorry, I think it's "go to the depths of those unknown places. You will not get lost there. Nothing is permanent, not even this."
Wow. Yeah, it's beautiful.
I love that, right? Like diving deep into this, but the one thing that you guys are so good at is avoidance, right? And it is a trauma response, right? Avoidance. Right. But when we avoid, we don't, we're not healing.
And I think it's not so much a choice, but a necessity sometimes. Because like Mike was saying earlier, he had a pretty bad shift recently where he had three back-to-back-to-back, you know, significant calls where, you know, it's, hey, get back on that horse because it's time to go again right away.
Right.
And so sometimes we don't always have that time. And then... time gets moving on, and then one gets pushed behind the other, and then it's like, oh, well, you know, and so sometimes we forget, you know, and we just need to be able to bring it back and remember that, you know, we need to be able to manage and keep everything in check.
Yeah.
Because if not,
then
we end up worse off, right?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So.
The important thing is to also... remember that when you talk about things that about this job or whatever that may make you feel vulnerable, that you're not vulnerable is not the right word when you're speaking to people who can do nothing but relate to you. It's just matter of fact. So don't feel like you can't talk about something that bothered you, because that dialogue will actually probably help you gain some insight into why it's bothering you so much.
Right.
And the other person is definitely going to be able to relate.
And probably, you know, open up.
Absolutely. Right?
You know, something they may not have talked about.
Right.
You open up and start by being vulnerable. But it opens up a very matter-of-fact conversation where they can relate and they can, you know, maybe it's something completely different, but maybe be able to have tools that they use that you can use that just helps both of you in the end. Yeah.
And I see that happen all the time. I talked to this crew one night, it's not that long ago, a couple of weeks ago maybe, and I was blown away by how helpful the partner was to the partner who was having, I wouldn't even call it a struggle, just really reviewing the call, you know, reviewing like, could I have done something better?
Oh my God, yeah.
Right? Which is completely typical,
the
right?
What ifs.
And also, like, it's part of the learning process too, right? It's part of, we can't be better if we don't reflect on what happened.
True.
So there is this sense that, like, there is a normalcy to that of, like, okay, could I have done this? Could I have done that? But this partner was, just said some of the most profound things, right? And I'm engaged in the conversation with them, and I'm thinking to myself, this kid's better than I am, right? Like, I have a freaking PhD, and this kid is like, I don't know, he's probably less than 30, he's probably 25 or something like that. And I'm like, this kid is just spot on right now with every single thing that he said.
That's so good.
And so I said to him, I was like, why aren't you on the peer support team, right? I'm immediately like recruiting. But like, to your point, talking this stuff out, even just simple things like, what did we do and how could we have done this better? Even if it's not pathological, right? Mm-hmm. Even if you're not like beating yourself up about what I could have done or better, you'd be surprised. Like, don't underestimate your partner.
Right.
Yeah. And what kind of insight they might have and what kind of wisdom they might have.
Sure.
Even if they're 22.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I was just totally blown away and I was so happy for both of them. And I worry about you guys. Right.
Yeah.
And I hung up and I was like,
he's got
good.
It. You got
good. It. He's in good hands. You know, like, he's in good hands with his younger EMT.
That's
who's
awesome.
Like,
yeah,
totally going to take care of him. That's emotionally
awesome.
Tonight.
That's
know?
Awesome.
Did you get him recruited into the port?
I mean, I'm trying. Okay. I'm still trying.
Good.
It's interesting though, because I think we all have perceptions of who people are when we don't fully know them.
Right.
And that was one of those things that I was like, my mind is completely changed about who this person is. Cause I just thought he's pretty quiet, you know? And I'm like, oh, this is like nice, quiet kid. And then I was like, boom, this dude's got like wisdom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At, you know, 20
awesome.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah. It's awesome.
It was amazing. So don't underestimate your partner.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good.
Yeah.
This has been great. Like, I think this has been amazing. This is one of, I think, our most important topics, you know, is grief, because almost everything we do, and like, you know, from those bad calls to those mundane calls, I think, you know, we stand the chance to bear that burden and carry that grief, and like for 30 years.
Yeah.
Right. And so unless we are able to manage it, mm-hmm. own it and manage it, it can get out of control and can cause us more grief.
Yeah.
Right.
So. All grief that we come in contact with activates our own grief, no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's impossible for it not to touch it. But Brian and I last night were watching a few clips from this woman who her social media tagline is emergency resilience. That's how you can find her, emergency resilience. But she had a few clips of death notifications, both in the hospital. She takes them from movies. And she does a voiceover over it and says, like, this was sound advice, or this, you know, maybe it should, this wasn't the best way to do it, but it's so hard to do it. So we like forgive people. Right. But if you want to check her out, she also has a death notification course that you can purchase for cheap. It's like $39 or something.
Right.
I don't know. But, she's really, really good. So when you're talking about death notices or thinking about it, or it's something, if it's something that scares you or you dread it or whatever it is, like, she's probably a really good resource to check out.
Excellent.
Well, and that brings up one other quick question I wanted to ask you, Mike.
Sure.
You're a training, field training officer, mm-hmm. right? And so when you have interns, mm-hmm. Is there, like, do you kind of give them, what do you give them?
So, you know,
to deal with this?
It's all relative to the intern,
right?
Right. So where are we going to focus our energy on, right? How busy is the truck? So on and so forth, right? Right. But the, I try to just make them aware of, briefly and in a very summarized manner, that you have to manage your personal life to be present here.
Right.
And you have to manage here to be present in your personal life.
Yeah.
And, you know, if that means making sure you have hobbies outside of work, you have meaningful relationships with friends and family, you're actively pursuing a career that you like, and you're financially stable, and you're not relying on drugs and alcohol to maintain yourself. If you can do those, maybe half of those things, three quarters of those things, and there's many other things you could list.
Sure.
Just off the top of my head. But if those things are kind of in line, it'll help you become present at work where you have to be present.
Right.
And not doing those things causes home and work to bleed together, and now you're never going to get a break. Home life is bad for whatever reason. Work's going to be bad too, because you're never going to get it out of your head. And the inverse is true as well. Work's bad, you got to bring it home with you.
Right.
And then now your people, your loved ones, are going to have to deal with some crotchety old medic. Like, nobody wants to deal with that.
Right.
You know what I mean? They don't deserve that. So, you know, those are just the things they don't teach you in school, and there's no mannequin for you to practice on. There's nothing for you to gauge how well your resilience is. It's something you have to learn on the road.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to at least make people aware of it so they can just, you know, eyes open. That's all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think to your point, too, about coming home and, you know, being the crotchety old medic, I think the important thing is that you establish whoever is living at your house with you, mm-hmm. anybody that's living there, mm-hmm. to be able to communicate to them what you need, mm-hmm. right? If your family or whoever's living in your house with you doesn't know or doesn't understand the job, you need to tell them, hey, you know, I need 30 minutes of silence before I can become, mm-hmm. before I can transition to,
sure,
flipping that coin that you, sure, said into, yeah, the dish, or removing your uniform or whatever it is. I need 30 minutes before I transition to dad or husband or brother or friend, right?
Right.
I need a minute, or maybe it's an hour, or maybe you need a nap, right? Whatever it is that you need, whatever your thing is, I think it's important that you establish that early on. These are for the new people, but early on, so that you don't run into problems around communication with people, mm-hmm. because lots of times people will tell me they come home and their significant other is like, oh my God, I got to tell you all this stuff, and this, right, happened and that happened, and, you know, my mother and the kids, and the person's like overwhelmed from, like you said, three back-to-back cardiac arrests, and you're walking in the door being bombarded by, you know, somebody who's just talking at you before you've even taken your coat off, and you can't process it. So, But it's not their fault, right? They don't, right, they've been, right, without you for 24, right, hours or 12 hours if you're 12. They just miss you.
Right.
Exactly. They just want to connect, exactly, yeah, right?
And share what they've had, right, going
what
on.
They've been going on, right, what's going on. But you might not be in that space. So our last guest, Michael Cunningham, was talking about his ritual, which was that he spends, he takes the long road home,
nice,
basically.
Nice.
Right?
Nice.
So he'll take a long, slow drive and listen to favorite music, comes in, says hi, and immediately works out.
Oh, smart.
So he has that distance, that space, enough to kind of burn off the stress hormones from the shift before and have a little quiet time, also a workout, and it works for him. So
good.
I think if you establish a good communication, you don't find yourself in turmoil in your relationships.
Yeah.
And plugging the book that I like to always plug, which I do not get kickbacks on, and I should call him.
Maybe we should.
Maybe we should get him on the show. And I sometimes apologize for butchering the things that he brilliantly talks about in this book, but it's called The Emotional Survival of Law Enforcement. And it's all completely applicable to all first responders. But I always recommend for people, I usually tell this both at the academy with at the police department, the new kids, and our NEOP folks, read this with your significant other. Read this with your family members. Because it gives them everything that they need to know about what this job entails and how it might impact the relationship if you don't communicate well.
Right.
If they don't understand. So highly recommend Dr. Kevin Gilmartin, The Emotional Survival of Law Enforcement. Okay.
Yeah, very perfect. Nice. All right, guys. Well, again, like I said, I think this has been an amazing, amazing talk and always. Show. And thank you, Mike, for
thanks, Mike.
Coming over. I know you live far away and you were on shift yesterday and this has been significant. So we really appreciate this. This is amazing.
I was really happy to be invited. Absolutely. Yeah. Anytime. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Cool. Anytime.
All right. Sounds good. You guys, next episode coming soon.
With Snoop.
Yeah. We're going to get our agent. We're going to have our
people call his people.
We'll get them in soon. All right, guys. It's been great. See you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
This has been an Olive Pit production. We hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for listening.